Midlands today with Tullamore Opel Church Road Tullamore. A new year? Get ready to go further with the new generation of Astra. Waiting for you at Tullamore Motors Opel. See tullamoremotors.ie. When people in the Midlands want to talk, they talk to Will Faulkner.
Well, good morning. How are you? Have a good weekend. Yes, I know what it sounds like. Not exactly Barry White. No COVID. That's for sure, no COVID. But will the voice last until 12 midday? Apologies for sounding even more wretched than usual. Now, what is on the agenda this morning? The Minister for Health discusses a new hospice for the Midlands, the timetable for building the 20-bed facility in Tullamore. Excess deaths. Why are there more people dying in Ireland at the moment than should normally be the case? And Met Éireann has a warning for you and everybody in the Midlands over the next 48 hours. We'll hear what it is from a quarter to 10. Now, when you call 0818 300 103 is the Midlands 103 comment line. You can text, you can WhatsApp 083 30 10 103, powered by Lambrothers Toyota in Tullamore. What is on the front pages today? Well, the Irish Independent tells us how welfare rates will double for those who are high earners and who lose their job. So at the moment, it doesn't matter whether you are on minimum wage or whether you earn six figures a year. You will, if you lose your job, receive the standard rate of €220, give or take, every year. However, what's being planned is you will qualify for rates of up to €450 per week, depending on your earnings in the previous 5 years. It's capped at 60% of your gross weekly salary. So one of the obvious questions is, how is all this going to be paid for if social welfare rates are going up? And that part is unclear based on the article in The Independent today. More on that a little bit later. Also, by the way, you see on the front, TJ Reid of Ballyhale Shamrocks being congratulated by his wife with their newborn baby daughter, Harper, after his side defeated Dublin's Kilmacud Crokes to win the Leinster GAA Hurling Club Championship. And that brings me on to commiserating with the Downs, going down in defeat, unfortunately, to Kilmacud's footballers in the other final yesterday. But great to get that far in the competition, and well done to all concerned. Now, on the front of the Irish Times, Southern voters reluctant to change flag or anthem, according to two polls which have been carried out by the newspaper on attitudes towards a united Ireland. And they've been publishing this over the weekend. One of the polls indicated that while a majority here in the Republic would vote for a united Ireland if a referendum were held tomorrow, the majority of people in Northern Ireland would not. In fact, there were more than double the number of people opposed to a united Ireland in the six counties than those in favour of it. Quite a few undecided, but always when you've got people on the fence, they don't entirely transfer to one or another. So the chances of a united Ireland in the next 10 years, rather slim, if that poll is accurate. And then the second poll, which is covered in today's paper, looks at what you would be prepared to put up with in exchange for a united Ireland. And one of the big concerns here in the Republic would be peace on the island. If it were to impact peace, then fewer people would support it. Whereas in Northern Ireland, their big concern is how it would impact their health service. Both sides of the border worry about the economy. But when you get down into political institutions, things like that, not really a huge concern on anybody's radar, north or south. What are the tabloids talking about today? The killing of two men just on the border region in Monaghan last week. One, Kieran Hamill, who is suspected of killing the other man. He'd lost his life after a car collided with him while he was trying to make his escape. The paper says, killer takes murder secret to the grave. And Gorthy suspect they may never find out what was the true motive for the attack. The older man, however, was a convicted sex offender. That is certainly one theory they are exploring as to whether there was any link between the two. Anything else on the front pages that is of interest? Not really. Let's dig inside. First of all, a little bit of good news, because you hear a lot of doom and gloom about the economy, about Ireland, and whether we have a basket case in government, in the Department of Finance, mismanaging all the money in and the money out. Well, actually, David McWilliams is very positive about the future for Ireland. Unlike countries such as Qatar, for all of its wealth, and you can see it on display during the World Cup, and the vast oil resources that they have at their disposal, he makes the case that natural resources eventually run out. And if you're a one-trick pony as a country, then you're in trouble. And he looks at how Ireland has become a service-driven economy. He looks at how even in agriculture, which was what we were once known for almost entirely, we don't just export foods, we export serums, hormones, other agri-tech products. And overall, he finds that we are one of the most diversified economies in the world, and that is something to be positive about. So, while the cost of living is going up, and while, yes, we're all a little bit under the weather financially, it's not going to last forever, he says. Now, yes, here's one that is perhaps a little bit of optimism in the health service, because waiting lists are almost criminally long in this country, and you can avail of the National Treatment Purchase Fund to go abroad and get your surgery there. But actually, the government is going to invest 100 million euro in surgical hubs, which will be in Dublin, Limerick, Galway, Cork and Waterford. And these hubs will be set up in the next 12 to 18 months. Many of them will be modular builds. They'll go up very, very quickly. And the expectation is once the staff are in place, these specialist centres will perform surgeries in urology, vascular medicine, orthopaedics, gynaecology, and all of that will hopefully reduce the waiting lists. The one slightly disappointing aspect of the plan is the geography of it. Yes, the major population centres are in Dublin, Limerick, Galway, Cork and Waterford. But if you put such a centre in the Midlands, and yes, we will unashamedly fly the flag for the Midlands, there are a lot of people who would find it closer to them than any of the cities at the edge. Anyway, we will make the case and see what happens. Are you concerned about a dog in your housing estate? Because after what happened in County Wexford last week, a 9-year-old boy being mauled by a pit bull and unfortunately being left with life-changing scars. Well, dozens of attacks involving pit bulls have been reported, and the Irish Independent has looked at the counties where this seems to be a particular problem. Wexford, actually, where the attack I mentioned, where that took place, that had, in the last year, 15 incidents involving pit bulls. No Midlands local authority is mentioned in the article, but I wonder if you have had reason to report a dog in your area, were you satisfied with the outcome? Did the council follow up promptly? Or was it just written down on a notepad somewhere and never ever followed up on? What was your experience? One or two more very, very quickly before the voice goes completely. Met Éireann is warning of very cold weather this week. An Arctic air mass is setting in over Ireland, and we can expect sharp to severe frost and very icy stretches on roads, particularly in the middle of the week. So if you're planning to commute early in the morning or indeed late at night, just expect hazardous conditions and plan accordingly. And one more. Music. What were the biggest songs of the year? And traditionally, we look at the charts. Who bought whose CD? Who was played on the radio? But these days, we can look at Spotify, because the streaming charts show what people themselves decide to listen to. And Taylor Swift has been the most streamed artist in Ireland over the last 12 months. But here's the slightly worrying question for Irish artists. Why is there only one Irish artist in the top 10? And that is Dermot Kennedy. And indeed, only one Irish song in the top 10, which was from the Dublin duo Belters Only. Their dance number, Make Me Feel Good, came fourth out of 10. So, bit of a challenge for Irish artists. And here's another little statistic for you. If you are played on Spotify, your own song, you will get 1 cent for every 18 times it is streamed. You're not going to get rich in a hurry at that rate, are you? It would take 3.5 million Spotify streams a month for you to earn the minimum wage. Wow. Would you be a musician in this day and age? I don't think so. It's another day on the Midlands 103 Advent calendar. Another huge prize, with thanks to Arcadia in Athlone and our various other supporting partners. And I will tell you very soon what today's question is and how you can enter. And the very best of luck to you. The Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, was in Tullamore, Portlaoise and Mullingar on Friday. He said a new hospice in Offaly will be the main pillar in a proper palliative strategy for the Midlands. It will be a 20-bed facility right next door to Tullamore Hospital. He hopes it will be complete by the end of 2025. The minister visited the grounds and spoke with Midlands 103's Cameron Clark.
It's going to be based here in Tullamore. It's going to be 20 beds. It's going to be the main pillar of a proper palliative care strategy for the Midlands, including the hospice that'll be here, 20 beds, level 3, including the next level down, which is the level 2 beds, which we'll have around, and then, really importantly, community palliative care services as well, adult services and also paediatric services. So that's one of the reasons. As you'll be aware, we allocated a large amount of money to, we've made an exception specifically for the Midlands Hospice, where the state is investing a very large amount of money. The groups that we met here today have been fundraising and campaigning and advocating for many years. Barry and I have been talking about this hospice now for a long time. And as you know, the Taoiseach came here recently enough and announced it. So one of the things I wanted to do was meet everybody here, get their thoughts on where it's at, and their thoughts on the rest of the strategy as well, because this obviously is just one part. The second reason I'm here is to meet the frontline healthcare workers, to meet the management in the hospital to see what more they need. And I have to say, the team in Tullamore Hospital are very impressive. Not only have they been dealing with COVID and all of the extra work and all of the pressures involved in that, at the same time, they've done an incredible job in reducing the number of patients on trolleys, even though the number of patients coming to the hospital has gone way up. Actually, the number of people being admitted has gone way down. So I met with the emergency department team to see what they're doing. And actually what we're seeing here is great cooperation across the hospital, great cooperation with the community services, lots of different referral pathways for the patients who are coming in so they don't end up on a trolley. And I have to say, I've been really impressed by the way the hospital's been run and by the way the emergency department's been run, all of it starting and ending with the patient and patient flow. We've also been talking about waiting lists. Big focus for government, big focus for me, is making sure that the numbers waiting too long for care go down. And we're seeing that here. When what the hospital here has been doing is they've been focusing on patients waiting more than a year and a half, more than a year, more than 6 months. And those numbers are dropping very significantly. Now, the total number waiting is about the same, but that's because there's so many people coming in. They've done huge work here to get those numbers down. The next thing I wanted to discuss with them is what else is needed. And we were talking about extra ICU capacity. We were talking about extra HDU capacity, high dependency unit capacity, and various other capital investment. They have a proposal for an extension to the emergency department, which I think we should look on very favourably. Okay. And one of the messages I had for the team here in the hospital is, we need to move to a position where government and the HSE are investing in success. So what has happened for a long period of time is, when things go wrong and when waiting lists get too big and when there's too many patients on trolley, that's when people invest. I mean, obviously you have to invest there as well, but sometimes the people who are doing well get ignored because there isn't a crisis in their hospital. One of the things I wanted to say to them today here is, we recognize the good work you're doing, and we're going to continue to invest and really to just acknowledge the incredible work. There's an amazing passion in that. You can feel it in a hospital where the team, where the doctors, the nurses, the therapists, the management within the hospital just care passionately about providing the services for the patients, and you could really feel that here today.
An Offaly woman here from the county reached out to us yesterday. Her and her husband have been diagnosed with cancer. She travels to St. James's in Dublin, he travels to Galway because of the cost of hospital parking charges and how expensive they are. Obviously they're in and out of hospital very frequently. What can be done to help people like them and long-term patients?
Well, first of all, can I extend my best wishes to both of them. They're both being treated in state-of-the-art hospitals. The cancer care that is provided in those hospitals is recognised as world-class. And so most importantly, can I extend my best wishes to them, and I hope they're doing okay. It's a very, very difficult time for anyone who's going through treatment for cancer, and I just want to say I hope they're okay, and I've no doubt that they're getting the best possible care. We have a big focus on reducing costs for patients right across the board. In 2021, there's several things we did. I extended medical cards for those with a terminal diagnosis from 1 year to 2 years. And we extended medical cards for over 70s. We reduced prescription charges as well. This year then, we've done a lot more things. We've abolished pediatric hospital charges, so children's hospital charges for inpatient charges are gone. We've had a big reduction in the drug payment scheme from 114 to 80 euro. So I obviously don't know the couple you're talking about, but many people in that situation are having to buy quite expensive pharmaceuticals on a monthly basis. So the costs of them have now fallen very significantly from 114 to 80. We've brought in free contraception this year, which has been received very well for 17 to 25 year olds, and I want to see free GP cards in for 6 and 7 year olds by the end of the year. So we're going further next year. Next year we're abolishing hospital inpatient charges for adults, essentially now for children and adults, from next year there'll be this 80 euro a night charge will be gone. So for example, this is something that the Irish Cancer Society was one of their big asks for the budget for this year, and they were very happy to see it brought forward. And the point they made, and we all know people in this situation, someone who's been treated for cancer, someone who may be very, very sick and maybe in a very bad way, not only are they having to deal with all of the difficulties and the trauma involved in being treated for cancer, they could then get sent an 800 euro bill because of the nights that they spent in hospital. From next year, that's gone. And there's more we're doing. We're bringing in state-funded IVF for the first time. We're expanding free contraception, hopefully down to 16 and then up to 30. So we're targeting costs for patients right across the board. We're bringing in GP cards now to the median income. So over the next few months, 500,000 more men, women and children in Ireland will now have state-funded access to GPs.
Okay. The latest trolley figures show that Mullingar Hospital has four times more people on trolleys this month than Port Leash and twice as many than here in Tullamore. Mm. Are there any plans in place to support the hospital? This is even with the new minor injuries unit that's been set up.
I'm on my way up to the hospital right now. What I wanted to do, I met the team in Leash and saw what's working for them. I've just met the team here in Tullamore and seen what's working for them, and I'm on my way now to Mullingar. A winter plan has been put in place hospital by hospital. So extra resources are being deployed, extra consultants, extra nurses, extra healthcare assistants. In a lot of cases, actually, the most important thing is discharge options. It's not the emergency department itself, though we are very significantly increasing the staffing in the emergency departments. Actually, what we're seeing a lot is that there's delayed transfer of care. So there's patients in the ward beds who really should be in a community nursing unit or in a rehab bed or in a step-down bed, or to being supported at home, and they're finding that more and more difficult, and of course that then feeds all the way back to someone being on a trolley. So what I want to do is hear directly from the people running the emergency department, from the clinical director in the hospital, from the management in the hospital, from the nursing directors in the hospital, to say what's working, what's not working, and what more do you need.
And that's Stephen Donnelly in conversation with Midlands 103's Cameron Clark. Now, if you agree with anything the minister said, if you disagree with anything the minister said, the best way to reach me, text or WhatsApp, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore, 083 30 10 103. Will, can you please wish Denise Malie a very happy birthday? We won't say what age she is, says Colette, Billy, Tiffany, Macy and Freya. And enjoy your special day, Denise. Have a great one, is the message. Julianne in Glasson, after hearing about the specialist surgical hubs that are promised, and also Stephen Donnelly's comments, Will, I am waiting for surgery on my knee and my shoulder. I met with a consultant 2 months ago. He took my phone number. I've heard nothing since, she says. Oh dear, on your knee. And I know how much you love to run, Julianne, so that's going to be a big setback. But I've no doubt you'll be on the mend very, very quickly whenever the surgery happens. That's the big if and when. And one other message about hospitals. Will, it sounds to me like there are too many directors in hospitals and not enough workers. We need more hands-on people. We all know what is wrong, and also visiting times need to be addressed. Trying to blame COVID and lockdowns is not an acceptable reason to restrict visitors any longer, says Geraldine. Thank you indeed. And one more on a different subject from Thomas, who is quite concerned about motorways, having dropped his son to the airport on Saturday night and returned to discover lights off at all of the junctions. And the road markings were quite poor in many areas. Bloody dangerous, he says. That's perhaps taking cost saving a little too far. And surely they have motion activated sensors. You could turn off the lights while there are no cars on the motorway, and then turn them back on again when a car or a lorry approaches. Shouldn't be beyond all possibilities. Anyway, that may not be the biggest motoring hazard of the week. Watch out, because a cold snap is on the way, and let's get more details now from Cathal Nolan of Ireland's Weather Channel. Good morning, Cathal.
Well, a very good morning, Will.
What are you expecting?
Well, certainly, I suppose we've already started to see that colder air mass filtering across the country. It's likely to get particularly cold from really Wednesday onwards. At that particular point in time, we see a very cold plunge of northerly air coming in from the Arctic regions. And with that, it will lead to the introduction of certainly severe night frost. Daytime temperatures will struggle in the Midlands to get above freezing. And in the northern half of the Midlands, there's a slight risk as well of some wintry precipitation at times, possibly falling slow with some small accumulations in places. But I think predominantly for the Midlands, it looks as though it'll just be the temperatures that really have the biggest impact on our weather.
So once this happens, Wednesday onwards, what sort of temperatures daytime, what sort of temperatures nighttime can we expect?
I suppose daytime values really for the remainder of the week from Wednesday onwards, Wednesday to Thursday onwards, they're likely to struggle to get above freezing in many parts. So you're talking maybe daytime maximum values around about freezing 0, 1, 2 degrees Celsius at best. There will be some good sunshine at times, So certainly it will feel quite nice, very cold, very crisp conditions. But with that, there is the slight risk of some wintry precipitation at times, especially the northern half of the Midlands. Here, there could be one or two wintry flurries at times, especially so maybe on Wednesday night into early Thursday, and then possibly again on Friday. But outside of that, it looks predominantly dry and bright. The nighttime temperatures, I suppose, certainly of note for motorists across the country, they're likely to get down to as low as -5, maybe -6 or -7 in one or two parts, certainly one or two of the rural spots that are favoured. And I suppose as the cold spell continues on, we will see those temperatures continue to drop. So certainly values over the weekend could be down as low as maybe -5 to -7 degrees Celsius, possibly lower as we go into the start of next week.
Wow, well, county councils take note. The gritters and the road treatment will be a priority. Especially on those local and regional roads. How long is this likely to last, Cathal?
I suppose looking at the models at the moment, and the two main ones that we look at is the European model and the American model. Both those models at present seem to indicate that this cold spell will become a prolonged feature. Prolonged, I suppose, we're looking at in terms of the reality, the model forecast, the moment of reliability, but certainly up until around about Wednesday the 14th, Thursday the 15th, until that time at least, it looks as though we will have some particularly cold weather in place. Beyond that, it doesn't look like changing too significantly for the remainder of that week also. So we're talking about at least 10 to possibly 14 days for cold spell.
Could get tricky if, let's say, a warmer air mass moves up from the Atlantic and you get the two clashing. Is there a risk of snow other than the initial flurries you mentioned in northern parts of the Midlands?
I suppose looking at present at the moment, there doesn't seem to be that immediate risk, let's say. But again, as you said, there very much is the possibility that somewhere during this cold spell, a low pressure system tries to push up from the south, which of course is what brought the particularly heavy snow and the blizzard conditions with Storm Emma back in 2018. That could occur potentially during this particular spell, but at present, that scenario isn't particularly favoured. It's more so just the initial risk of wintry precipitation, specifically along northern, northwestern coastal areas, maybe eastern coastal areas at times. But for the Midlands, it looks as if it'll be predominantly the cold temperatures that will become the main feature of our weather.
All right, and we can plan accordingly. Thank you very much, sir.
Pleasure as always, Will.
That's Cathal Nolan, originally from Road in County Offaly. And if you look up Ireland's Weather Channel on Facebook, you can keep up with him there. Ina, following up on the earlier text about motorway lights being switched off, Ina was travelling in the direction of Curramore National School in Mullingar at around 10:30 on Friday night, and she found the schoolyard illuminated with high-powered lights and not a cricket near the place, she says. Talk about conserving energy. And one more message. Will, does the County Council grit the road that you travel every morning? I go that way every day, says Ollie. No, very often not. Not from Clonbillogue anyway. Although between Edenderry and Tullamore, that main road is generally treated. But the odd morning, they seem to forget or get caught unawares. And certainly councils right across the Midlands have ample notice that from Wednesday onwards, road conditions are going to be hazardous first thing in the morning because of freezing conditions. So we have been warned. Now, Joe has been in touch about hypocrisy because he says up the road from him, there is a house with lights on day and night. And yet, he says, these neighbours will not cut the grass for fear of hurting snails. And he just cannot understand one action against the other. Thank you, Joe. Now, still to come today, the dream ends for the Downs at the hands of Kilmacud Crokes. Your full sports review is in a little over an hour's time. Excess deaths is a rather cold statistical term. In effect, it measures whether more people are dying in an area than would ordinarily be the case. And it is an important measure of how well a health system is doing its job. And it has caught the interest of Padraig Tobin, who is a TD in Meath West and also the leader of AIMTO. Padraig Tobin, good morning.
Good morning to you.
What have you found out?
Well, I've been looking at the Eurostat figures month on month over the last year. And I found out that in July this year, we saw a big spike in the number of excess deaths. So in July, we saw that the number of deaths was 16% higher than it was for the previous year. And in August, that same trend continued, with the August figure being 17% higher. And actually, August was such an outlier that it was the fifth highest death rate since January 2020. So August has, you know, was competing with some of the worst months of COVID and, you know, still having a higher rate of death with them, you know, in the last 2 years, which is extraordinary because, you know, most people would have thought that, you know, thankfully COVID has subsided, not disappeared, but subsided. Mm. And as a result, you know, the death rate will be significantly higher. But in this period of really kind of non-COVID activity, actually the death rate was just as high, if not higher, than most of the COVID months. And then the CSO produced figures just in the last few days, and they showed that in quarter two this year, there was a 39% increase in the number of deaths compared to quarter two in the previous year. So the figures that have been coming true on the statistics have had an incredible outlier characteristic, far higher than other years and even higher than many of the COVID months as well. And
do the figures point to a cause? Are they that granular?
Well first of all, they didn't, unfortunately. So we put a question into the Minister for Health to say, one, why was this happening? And two, was there an investigation into it? And the Minister came back to us with a response from the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, whose job it is to track illnesses such as COVID. And they admitted that during some of the periods of this year, there has been excess deaths. Now, they attributed that down to what they call the impact of the COVID pandemic. So in other words, the impact of actually some COVID still around causing death, but also to, and this is very important, to the lack of treatment and health services for people who have had other illnesses. So while they didn't say this, you know, this is, it's understood that people with cancer, people with heart disease, people with stroke, people with mental health issues obviously didn't get the treatment that they needed during the COVID years because in part the government closed down some of those services and in part patients were fearful of going near the health service during this time. And the danger is now is that many of these illnesses haven't been treated and are at a far more advanced stage and therefore are impacting people in terms of deaths. And in Britain, if we look across the water, they've been very good, in fairness to them, in carrying out these investigations. And they're tracking that there's actually a big tidal wave of, you know, very serious illnesses in these disease areas as a result. And as you know, they're trying to invest funds into the health service to deal with that crisis. But the problem is here in Ireland, that's not been done at all. There's been no investigation over the actual impacts of non-COVID illnesses. And as a result, there's no response in terms of investment. So we in AIM2 have been calling on the government to carry out the investigation, get to the bottom of this, find out what's going on, and then put the necessary investment in so people who have cancer, heart disease, stroke, mental health issues, they get the treatment that they need. Now, there's one caveat to this, and one of the reasons why some people feel that the figures are higher this year is that we had a cyber attack last year, and that cyber attack would have made it more difficult for deaths to be registered last year, and as a result, some of those deaths may just be being registered this year. However, that can't make up for all of these numbers, and that's why we believe an investigation is necessary at this stage.
Well, best case scenario, there's a data entry. Worst case scenario, or a data error, I should say. Worst case scenario is there are people who require treatment and extra resources need to be put in place. How do you, what questions have to be asked to figure out the difference?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, what needs to happen is that proper investigation. We need to make sure that the deaths are registered properly and on time in this country. Now, there are other data sources, such as RIP.ie, for example, is a very good data source because everybody who's buried in the state has their their death registered with RIP.ie, and that information needs to be collected to see how far out the government CSO figures are, and we're calling on the government to do this immediately. And the second issue then is we need to actually find out what is the state of play with each particular health service. So I remember speaking to cancer consultants, and they were telling me that breast cancer screening was closed down during COVID. People had found it far more difficult to get cancer treatment in certain circumstances. Because of the restrictions, one particular consultant told me that his 2-year waiting list for cancer had become a 6-year waiting list because he could take far fewer people in to see them. And it has to be remembered that, you know, cancer is the biggest killer of all, far, far bigger than COVID. And, you know, every day dozens of people will die of cancer. So we can't afford ever to put cancer patients on hold. Cancer doesn't wait. It's as simple as that. And we need to make sure that the investment goes in straight away to make sure that all cancer patients have the treatment that they need. And we still know that, you know, even children have had chemotherapy cancer treatments postponed as a result of the crisis in the health service and of COVID. And that's simply not tolerable. It can never be the case that a child facing, you know, the disastrous diagnosis of cancer would have their chemotherapy cancelled and then potentially the illness becoming you know, far more embedded, you know, far more advanced, and needing far more, you know, invasive surgery potentially to be treated. All cancer patients need their treatment ASAP.
What's the best way to use that investment? Because I think if the HSE were to run a recruitment campaign, bring in extra consultants, it may not be successful, number one, based on what we've seen in the past, and it will take time. During COVID, there was a deal done very quickly with the private hospitals, for instance, to take up capacity there. Should that be considered? Should it be National Treatment Purchase Fund and send some of the patients abroad? What's the most effective way to do this quickly?
Well, I do believe that in any crisis, it should be all hands on deck. So it does need to be that all services are orientated towards the people who need it. That's absolutely the case. But we in AIMTO believe that there's a problem within the HSE, a big problem. That is that investment gets lost in the HSE. So the government increased the investment year on year, but that investment doesn't seem to be getting to the front line. We want the HSE to change its funding policy so that hospitals and healthcare units get paid for each time they treat a person, that they diagnose a person, that they deliver a service to a person, that they carry out an operation. So activity-led investment. Now, if a hospital is only getting paid on the basis of every activity they carry out on behalf of a patient, well, then that hospital will orientate its own funding to the front line, to exist, to be able to keep going. But, you know, right now, a lot of that funding is getting caught up in middle management. And middle management doesn't provide a frontline service. And also, it actually can make it more difficult to manage because you have more layers of management, which means managers are managing management on a daily basis. And that's no good to the patient. So that's the first issue that we want to see in terms of this. We want the investment to go directly to the frontline. We want the government to be able to say and mean it to doctors and nurses that we are going to provide proper terms and conditions for staff. Because right now I know one of the reasons why so many doctors and nurses are leaving the health service in Ireland is that the conditions are actually getting worse at the moment. In Drogheda Hospital on Saturday night, there was 11 ambulances parked outside of the A&E. They were unable to leave the A&E because they couldn't take their patients off their ambulances because the A&E inside was full. So those ambulances couldn't go out and pick up new patients who were in an emergency because they were stuck at the hospital. Yet, this government are looking to close down the A&E in Navan starting from December 12th, which would mean that there would be more ambulances going into Drogheda on a daily basis. So the government have to stop closing down capacity, opening up capacity, investing in frontline services so that the pressure comes off each individual doctor and nurse so that they don't feel the need to leave the service either.
Padraig Tobin, I've no doubt we'll come back to this as the figures keep coming in, and thank you very much for highlighting it.
Thank you.
Padraig Tobin is the leader of AIM2. He's a TD for Meath West. Hello and good morning to Maurice Deegan, who refereed his final game in Croke Park yesterday, and a few people have texted to wish him well, not just because it was his last game, but because he took a mighty belt during the course of it and will no doubt be feeling the effects today. And, well, good wishes to him in the future from all who have been in touch. We will, by the way, have our full sports review in an hour's time. It did not go well for the Downs. The dreams have been dashed. Kilmacud proving just that bit too strong. But Kilmacud's hurlers, despite a fantastic comeback, unable to overcome Ballyhale Shamrocks in the hurling championship. Anyway, more in sport in an hour. There were nearly 50 fewer beds in Midlands nursing homes in 2021 than was the case the year before. The latest report from the regulator HICWA finds there were 1,500 beds in the region at the end of last year. And as you may know, a number of nursing homes closed their doors this year altogether. The Deputy Chief Inspector is Susan Cliff. She's been explaining the drop in beds to Midlands 103's Cameron Clark.
This report presents the number of closures of nursing homes and the number of centres that have reduced their numbers of beds over the last 2 years, over 2020 and 2021. And there are several reasons. Some of the reduced bed capacity, so a nursing home which closed beds in the nursing home but the nursing home stayed open, may have been in order to come into compliance with regulations which took effect on the 1st of January. Others reflect the closure of nursing homes. And there are many reasons behind the closure of nursing homes. There may be that the current generation of the provider, the family who run the nursing home, want to retire, but the next generation are not interested in running the business. There is an element whereby some nursing homes have reviewed their buildings and have determined that the costs to bring the building into compliance with our regulations or maybe with fire safety regulations would not actually be justified. So in other words, the cost of credit and the cost of construction actually doesn't make it a sound business decision. Then there are other issues. You know, people would say that there's market forces involved in it. So residents coming to live in a nursing home may be deciding that they don't want to live in a twin room and they're choosing to move to nursing homes that have single accommodation. And then there's the underlying funding model, which many providers have identified as a key issue as well in the sustainability of their business.
Susan, the HICWA report also monitored the nursing home's response to the COVID pandemic. Obviously, it broke in 2020. How did nursing homes in the country respond?
Well, I think this report showed that the last 2 years have been a very, really difficult time for residents of nursing homes, their families, and those who work in nursing homes. 91% of centres experienced an outbreak of COVID-19. Many residents and staff were exposed to the virus and became unwell. Sadly, many people died due to the virus, and our sympathies go to all those who lost loved ones and friends during this time. But we have seen great strength and resilience in residents, staff and providers of nursing homes, and in many cases, an ability to adapt to a very different way of life. Despite the difficulties of the 2 years, what the report shows and what our compliance findings show is that many providers continue to have high levels of compliance and deliver a good person-centred care where the residents' rights are upheld and the residents have a good quality of life. And we've provided some examples of this in this report. But issues brought into focus during the COVID-19 pandemic included infection prevention and control arrangements and staffing shortages. And also the report shows that many issues raised in previous years have persisted and in some cases deteriorated further. So these would be issues including premises, fire safety and effective governance and management arrangements.
Susan, the HIC report highlighted some meaningful activities that were carried out by nursing homes. Bethany House was one of those mentioned, and it said that it provided some of the residents, those that were able, to fly by helicopter above their previous homes. How do meaningful activities like these, how do they benefit the residents of the homes?
Nursing homes provide a social model of care. And anything that gives the residents, you know, meaningful activities, access to their communities, something to look forward to, is a really good thing for a nursing home to have in place. And we've seen that over the last few years, nursing homes providing more and more a social model of care. These are really important to the residents. They're really important to the relatives as well. And many residents are looking for these kind of activities. Now, not everybody's looking for a trip in a helicopter. But, you know, they're looking for activities that will make their day meaningful. Nobody wants to end up living in a nursing home where you're simply sitting in a room looking at a wall. That's just not acceptable in these days. And that's not type of care that's provided in nursing homes today. So while Bethany House went above and beyond in more ways than one, you know, many nursing homes have done really well, especially in the challenges of the last 2 years, you know, where people couldn't come into the nursing homes. The residents, the staff of the nursing homes went above and beyond to provide the residents with meaningful activities and, you know, something to look forward to each day.
HICWA has called for more reforms and powers for a couple of years now. What would a greater power for the health regulator allow you to do?
We've called for a review of the legislative framework that underpins the registration of nursing homes. And it's not just about the powers that are available to the chief inspector. We have looked for a review so that the regulation is focused on the services that can be delivered. But then we have looked for a review of the stages of the powers that are available to the chief inspector. So at the moment, the nuclear option is available. The chief inspector can go into the district court and seek an order to close a nursing home where there is a risk to the life and well-being of residents. The other option is she can issue a notice under Section 51 of the Health Act, but that's a very prolonged process and it's usually used where there are less serious, so there isn't an immediate risk to the life and limb of residents. But it's for something in between those two spaces, because the second process I've described there can be very protracted and you're subject to times in the district court. But equally then, in the past, we've also been subject to judicial review of those decisions, which can lead to those decisions being very protracted. So there's currently work underway. The chief inspector is engaging with the Department of Health to find regulatory powers or to define regulatory powers that would sit in the space between that nuclear option of immediate closure and the protracted process of closure that's the only other option at the moment.
And that report by Midlands 103's Cameron Clark. Susan Cliff is the Deputy Chief Inspector at HICWA. And particularly, as he said, in the Athlone area, there have been a number of closures of nursing homes this year. Now, still on the agenda this morning, if the voice holds up, that is, higher dole for high earners who lose their jobs. Is that a good move? Or should it just be higher dole for everybody? And did you happen to notice a ring around the moon on Saturday? A few people have sent in very nice images. I wonder what caused it. It certainly caught many people, caught many people's attention. Next, though, we turn our attention to losing weight over the age of 40 because the metabolism naturally slows down a bit. And a new book claims to have the solution, particularly if you are a woman. For the people who noticed this ring around the moon on Saturday night, the answer has been supplied by Lucas in Port Arlington. He says it's called a moon aurora and it is caused by ice crystals in the cold air being highlighted by the natural moonlight. You see it from time to time, all right. It was very striking on Saturday. I was out walking the dogs and it was very noticeable, around about 8-9 o'clock at night. Now, this is possibly going to be the biggest selling book in the area of healthcare this Christmas, and it's got a very compelling title. But I suspect there will be much division among healthcare professionals as to the real answer. Why women over 40 can't lose weight. Now, the author looks at four different headings. Your diet is obviously one. She recommends as well weight training, stress management, and sleep. And suggests the following basic rules: that you should have a good serving of protein in every meal, eat three good meals per day, do not snack, make sure you enjoy your food, and make sure as much of your food is from scratch, therefore you're eating as little processed food as possible. So, that's the recipe, but does everybody agree? Well, Lucy Luby is a nutritionist in Mullingar, and Lucy, I know you've probably given that a bit of thought. I'm not suggesting for a moment that you're over 40. Good morning.
Absolutely not. Not in my head anywhere.
So, if you had somebody coming to you of a certain age, what would you be saying to them, first of all, as to the reasons it gets more difficult over 40 to maintain and control your weight?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you clarified that for one, Will, because the title of that book would annoy me straight away, that they can't lose weight, and it's been targeted at women as well. But yeah, no, it does get more difficult as we age, and that goes for both men and women. But the battle is that little bit harder for females, and usually that can be down to fluctuations in hormonal changes that are going on in the body, and stress management again then is a huge area for females of that age, because you know, as you're trying to ramp down, and take things a little bit easier, life is ramping up the pressures. You know, you might be living with teenagers, you might be the main carer in the family, you might be caring for older parents, you might be the main cook in the house, you might be trying to establish your career after maybe being at home for years, you might be going for promotion at work because you've worked all the way through your child rearing years, and that pressure just catches up with you, because as we age, things start to slow down, your sleep, it becomes impacted, and it just becomes harder to, I suppose, juggle all the balls that we have to juggle as we get older.
And is it the pressure itself and the stress that contributes directly to the weight gain? Or is it the impact of that stress by way of being time poor that it makes you less inclined to cook from scratch, for instance?
Yeah, I think like time poor is very much a planning and an organisation thing. And I think that the busier you are and the better you are at planning, the less time poor you are. That's a skill, and that is right across the board for both men and women. But the stress is a huge thing in relation to the impact that it has on our physical and mental being. Now take the physical, for example. You know, stress will release a lot of cortisol, which is a hormone, into the body. And once that cortisol is high for long periods of time in the body, it kind of drives your craving for carbohydrates. And it makes it very difficult for the body to actually lose weight, because it's the body is not getting the messages to burn fat. It's getting the messages to crave your carbohydrates. The other thing is stress then can have a very negative impact on your hunger hormones, which would be leptin and ghrelin. And their purpose, their function in the body really is, ghrelin tells you you're hungry and leptin tells you you're full, put very simply, okay? And if you're stressed or you're very tired, those messages aren't getting through clearly to that part of the brain, the hypothalamus in the brain telling you stop eating or eat. And another thing that I've noticed is, especially with a lot of the women that come to me, which would be mostly kind of in that 30s, 40s, 50s bracket, is that we're more inclined to skip meals if we're not cooking for people. So like, if I've noticed with men, if they get hungry, they will prioritize stopping and eating and having something to eat. Whereas women will go, oh, do you know what, I'll have something when the kids get in, or I'll have something when we sit down as a family. And that is something then that can really damage your metabolism, which is already slowing down. You know, but none of these things, like, it all sounds very negative. None of these things are insurmountable. They can all be very simply, you can put certain things in place to counter the natural processes that are happening as we age.
Such
like from
as?
35 onwards, for example, we all lose muscle mass. So that goes for males or females. It's harder for females because we have a higher body fat percentage naturally to men. So losing weight is already, we're already on the back foot when it comes to losing weight, okay? Because muscle burns fat, okay? So if you start losing your muscle mass, therefore your ability to burn fat stores declines. So most people think, okay, now then I need to do some form of exercise to build muscle. But if you don't have the time or you don't have the energy or the inclination or the love for exercise, one very simple thing you can do to maintain your existing muscle mass is to eat properly. Do not go long periods of time without food, and include a proportionate amount of protein, good quality lean protein sources with every single meal. Now, I know you mentioned at the start that this book discourages snacking, and I don't know that her theory behind that. But for me, I would encourage a lot of people to kind of have a small snack in between the main meals. And the reason for that is another hormonal change would be to control your blood sugar levels. I'm trying to avoid big spikes. You know, if you eat, your blood sugar spikes. So I try to get people to eat cleverly, that they have a lower blood sugar spike, because once your blood sugars are raised, your body has two choices: use this energy or store this energy. So if you're not very active, you eat food that spike your blood sugar too high, you tend to store more energy than you need to use. So that becomes an accumulation. And if you're in that mode of storing more than you're using, then basically it becomes almost impossible to lose to deal with the excess weight. So it's like you're standing on a beach and you're pushing back the waves rather than dealing with you know, what's on your agenda immediately. You're never getting to your to-do list. You're never tackling the actual stores of fat then, because you're just constantly dealing with you know, this stream of adding to the store all of the time.
So can we just flesh that out a little bit more? What snacks are appropriate, and at what point could you be accused of grazing?
Okay, so this is another mistake that a lot of people tend to do, and men too tend to be guilty of it. But one thing I would get people to think about is, where are your calories coming from? If they're coming, a large percentage is coming from snacks, okay? Why is that? Is that because you're skipping meals during the day? You know, are you snacking at night because you have this hunger or craving that you just cannot satisfy? And that is a big trap that a lot of adults, busy adults, tend to fall into. So come the evening, nothing will satisfy you. You're grabbing anything and everything. So a huge portion of calories are coming from snacking, and potentially far more calories than your daily requirement to lose weight. Okay. So really we need to be getting the bulk of our calories from our three main meals: our breakfast, our midday meal, and our evening meal. And a small portion of calories from snacking. Snacking is only really there, I would use it as a tool to stabilize blood sugars, not necessarily to fill you, just to keep you going in between meals, so that you don't hit that wall or that crash in the middle of the day. So I would encourage snacking on anything other than starchy carbohydrates. So no breads, no pasta, no rice, no crackers. And you're going, well, what is there to eat then if you don't do that? So, for example, a really good healthy morning snack would be a portion of fruit and maybe a yogurt. It could be an apple and a few nuts. Okay, and you're having, you know, the colour from your fruit, but you're also having that small little portion of protein, which will slow down the release of sugar into the bloodstream, and it just keeps you feeling satisfied for longer. And I find it works very well for the people that come to me if we can get them into a habit of eating meals and snacks that suit them. Then come the evening time, you don't have that hankering, that need to, I need something, I need something. And you actually feel full and satisfied. So therefore then, when you're tired in the evening, you're not relying on willpower to resist the biscuits or the chocolate or the crisps or whatever you like to go for. You know, you're full and satisfied, and your food choice is driven from that feeling of satisfaction. So you're more likely to choose the right thing the next day if you are full and satisfied come evening time.
Lucy, I think this could well be a two-part conversation because we've lots of questions and I don't have the time to get to them. Many wondering, for instance, about sleep and why, if you're inactive for 8 hours, why that's actually better than being inactive for maybe 5 hours. Can we come back to it on another day?
Absolutely. It's one of my pet topics, Will. Anytime, I love talking about it. People are sick listening to me talking about it.
You know your stuff. Lucy, thank you very much.
No problem at all. Thanks, Will, for your time. Bye-bye.
That's Lucy Luby, and you can look her up at Lucy Luby Nutrition. A listener in Athlone says they had a gastric sleeve surgery in Turkey in July, and ever since have been struggling to get protein-based foods into them, looking for ideas for a proper meal. Well, I think certainly we will chat with Lucy Luby again from Lucy Luby Nutrition, because there have been so many questions, and apologies, we just didn't have time to get to all of them. Now, earlier I mentioned surgery and these hubs that are to be created, specialist hubs in Dublin, Galway, Cork, Limerick, Waterford, of course, the major cities, to try and cut down on waiting lists. Well, Julianne Ryan text in response to that. Julianne, good morning.
Good morning, Will.
I believe you've had some difficulty with your knee, and whenever we've met, you've been an avid runner, very, very active. What sort of trouble have you had?
I have had ligament problems for started 3 years ago. I had pains in my knee, went to my GP, he sent me to get an MRI done, and I saw a ligament problem. He said, we'll try injections, which I have done, of steroid into my knee for the last 3 years. And I got the last injection last June to do the mini marathon. It didn't last 2 days when the knee was back hurting me again. So I left it at that. I was here at work and my knee locked. I was sitting on the chair having a cup of tea at work. I couldn't even get up off the chair with the pain in my knee. Called my GP, went over to Tullamore. Couldn't even get out to get a wheelchair to get into the hospital. Met a guy eventually. And he gave me tablets, and eventually walked his every couple of go on crutches, and I came home, and then I got called back in about 2 weeks the next day to get an MRI done. I showed I have a torn meniscus in my ligament in my knee. I need surgery. So he called back then about 2 weeks after that, and got the results of the MRI, and I met a trauma consultant. And he said, I'll give you an injection. I said, I don't want an injection. I've had them for the last 3 years. They're not working.
Yeah, you wanted the surgical option.
Yeah, so he said, why have you got an appointment with another guy? I said, because I got it in the post. Then I cancelled the second appointment. I took the appointment with the man, saw him, and he said, okay, you have to get surgery. So I said, that's fine, that's what I want. He took my number. He said, I'm going to do the scope. I'm going to do the surgery. He said, we'll do the scope into the knee. And if it is what the MRI says it is, we'll do the surgery, because it's not what we want. I've heard nothing since. Then, unfortunately, I had an appointment with Mr. Sheehan, and I cancelled that on the Friday of the long bank holiday weekend, as foolish I was. I rang back on the Tuesday morning to ask her to have the appointment back, and she said no. She said, you've cancelled it, you have to wait till whatever it is comes round again. So I'm back down to my GP 2 weeks ago, and this Thursday coming, and he wrote a letter back to Sheehan to tell him I need to get see him and get surgery done. and it's here at my shoulder and I've heard nothing.
So this surgery was to take place in part in Tullamore, would it be?
Yeah, it happened in Tullamore, yeah, but I've heard nothing.
And did they tell you how long the waiting list was?
No, never said what you said. Give me your number and I will call you for surgery, and I've heard nothing.
Right. I'm looking online and apparently more than 7,000 people per year have that particular procedure. So
please.
I don't know. Now, that's not all in Tullamore, obviously. That's right the health service. We will inquire, because that would be the trauma department, I assume, would it be? Orthopaedics, anyway.
The fellow I met was in the trauma, but even Mr. Sheehan, he's a different guy. He does these at meniscus and the ligament. He even calls me to be good, because that's what he did. And what the trauma fella, does he deal with meniscus and the ligament? I don't know, but he called me over to look at it.
Yeah, but I'm assuming it's Owen Sheehan. He's a trauma and orthopaedic surgeon. So,
Mr. Sheehan?
Yes, we'll contact Tullamore Hospital, find out how long the waiting list tends to be.
Yeah.
All right, Julianne, thank you.
Thank you very much, Will.
That's Julianne Ryan in Glasson. And I'm sure she's not alone waiting for that procedure. Meniscus sounds sore. Vi says the ring around the moon the other night was absolutely fabulous. In folklore, it was said to foretell bad weather. Chilly enough up there for the ice crystals to form. Well, certainly that would seem to be right based on what Cathal Nolan of Ireland's Weather Channel told us earlier. Freezing conditions right across the Midlands from Wednesday onwards, likely to last at least a week, maybe more. Now, do you agree with this policy? Higher dole for high earners who lose their job. Well, it's being considered at the Department of Social Protection. Heather Humphreys, the minister, will bring a memo to Cabinet tomorrow. So says Philip Ryan, who has the story in the Irish Independent. Philip, good morning.
Good morning.
What's the thinking here?
Well, look, this is something that Fine Gael have been flagging for a long time, while they've held the social protection portfolio in government. I think it goes back as far as even Leo Varadkar suggested it when he was there many moons ago, that there should be a pay-related benefit system for people who lose their jobs. So if you're in a job where you're quite well paid and you've made various financial commitments based on the salary you have, you're trying to look after your family, you're paying a mortgage, these type of things, that when you do, if you do lose your job, that whatever you would get of the state would be related to that amount. And because if you have been working through this period, that you have been paying PRSI contributions and that you should be rewarded for that and get something back for what you have put into the system.
So what scale are they proposing?
Well, what they're looking at the moment is if you've had, and again, this is just a proposal. This isn't in many cases that something goes to cabinet, it's a cabinet memo, that it means it's automatically going to become legislation. This is just something that they're toying with the idea. Well, maybe more than toying with it. But anyway, the rates that they're looking at are for if you have more than 5 years' worth of PRSI contributions when you lose your job, you would get up to 60% of your salary or 450 euro per week based on your gross salary. So the max you would get is 450 a week if you lose your job and you're a relatively high earner or a higher earner, let's say. And then if you have less than 5 years contributions, if you've between 2 and 5 years contributions under your PRSI, you would get 300 euros. And then anything below the 2 years contributions would be remain on the current amount, which at present, I think it's 208 euros, and that's due to go up to 220 euros in January following the budget commitments.
Now, the social protection budget as it stands is worth 2.2 billion euro per year. How much is all this going to cost?
I haven't seen any costs for this just yet. As we know at the moment, the unemployment is quite low in this country. They say it's at record levels of employment, and meaning that there's record levels of low employment as well. So it wouldn't be a big issue at the moment. Where it would become an issue is that if there is a massive wave of layoffs like we saw in the recession and other times during our history.
Well, we've seen it only in the last few weeks in the tech sector.
That's the point I was going to make as well, is that that's the type of sector that would benefit from a system like this and would make the new system quite costly, because a lot of those people who are working in your Googles, Facebooks or Twitters, that they get pretty good salaries. So that would be an issue for the government then if you have a large amount of that type of worker losing their job.
And historically, when there has been a recession, consumption falls. So it's jobs in retail, hospitality, those discretionary sectors that tend to suffer most. Many of those are people on lower wages, and they might make the case, why not hire welfare for all rather than just earning those earning more?
Yeah, and that's a fair point. And I think the Fine Gael way of looking at that would be that this phrase that they like to use of making work pay and encouraging people to get out there and work, and that it is essentially trying to target people who want to move up the chain, who want to get their jobs and have the knowledge that there's a safety net there if something bad is to happen and they were to lose their employment.
So around the cabinet table, obviously, you've Fine Gael ministers, but you've also Fianna Fáil ministers and Green ministers. Do you know how the other partners feel about this?
Don't. That'll probably come out if it does. If they're, like I said, it's early days, so the cabinet will discuss it tomorrow, and ministers from all sides will get to give their views.
All right. Philip Ryan of the Irish Independent, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Philip Ryan is political editor with The Independent, and you can read more on independent.ie today. Is it something you would support on the principle of if you've worked and you've contributed more because your wages were higher, that you should get a better return when the downturn comes and you lose your job? Or are you in the camp that would say, well, all workers should benefit from higher dole if the worst should happen? 083 30 10 103 on text and on WhatsApp. Now, if you were at any of the games over the weekend, particularly if you were watching Kilmacud Crokes take on the Downs, and unfortunately the dream of the Downs died, a very substantial scoreline in favour of the Dublin club, and also Maurice Deegan hanging up his referee jersey as well for the final time and taking quite a few belts during the course of a very physical game in Croke Park. Not a lot of support for the proposal going to Cabinet tomorrow that higher earners should receive higher dole if they lose their job. Let me just give you a sample. From Christine, who says, I do not agree that higher paid people should get a higher rate of dole because this will discourage them from going back to work straight away. It might even encourage them to leave work for a while. Maybe if it was set for a period of time, 6 weeks or something like that, and then the rate dropped to the same as everybody else, then I could get on board with it. That's from Christine. Another listener says, well, didn't we try this? Pay-related social insurance was supposed to give us the higher benefits, but instead, that's not happening. That's from Grace. I'm not seeing anybody in favour of this as I scan through the messages. So if you are somebody on a higher income and you feel this is high time, bloody right, I've been paying more tax, more PRSI all my life, and therefore expect a higher rate of dole than somebody who's on minimum wage. If that's you, 083 30 10 103 on text and WhatsApp. Tell me why you feel that way.
The Monday Sports Review, brought to you by Slater Kia. Introducing the new EV6 fully electric SUV with a range of over 500 kilometres. Find out more at Slater Kia Mullingar.
Time to catch up on everything that was happening over the weekend and say good morning to David Hollywood, our sports editor. How are you, David?
I'm very well, Will. Thanks, Hank. How are you?
I'm grand. The voice sounds worse than I am.
I had to ask.
Thank you. Now, let's move on to the Leinster Senior Football Championship final, which was played out yesterday, and the Downs were defeated. And it has to be said, the Kilmacud Crokes, they were deserving Leinster champions based on that performance yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. A finish 112-8 points, it doesn't really reflect the superiority of the Dublin side. Just like in 1972, last time the Downs were in a Leinster final, they were well beaten on this occasion. A lot of the time, I think people like to think of club football as being something that can somewhat transcend inter-county dynamics. A good club from a small county, as in a small GAA county, as it were, they can still go far if everything aligns, as it were. But that inter-county divide was pretty apparent in Croke Park yesterday. The Downs would be disappointed with their performance, but Kilmacud Crokes, they basically should be winning games like this considering their resources. They've got so many of that once dominant Dublin inter-county panel on their side. And then if you throw Shane Walsh into the mix, a Galway man whose life outside GA means he lives in Dublin like so many young people do. He's from a club in Galway, Kilcarran Clonburn in Galway, and they would have the services of one of the country's best footballers. And you know, that's when a club can really go above and beyond maybe its county surrounds. Not that Galway's insignificant in that respect. But he's studying in Dublin. He can't play for a Galway club in terms of like the practicalities of his life. It would be completely unfair. And everyone in amateur sports, we kind of join clubs in the area that we live or our life operates. That's why they're a benefit to our lives. Anyway, he scored 6 points in the first half for Kilmacud Crokes. He dominated the game from start to finish, and it was that first half that killed the Downs. They were 1-9 to 1 point down after that first 30-minute period.
Wow.
You don't come back from that. Simple as. Larwall's side, they were against the wind in that first half. And on our commentary, Gerry Buckley was saying before throw-in that it seemed like a 5 or 6 point wind. And by Gerry's metric then, the Downs were still significantly off the pace. They conceded a goal very early on, a soft one too, which would have taken the wind out of their sails. No pun intended there, I apologise. Crucially, that 1 point is really the end of it when it comes to any sense of having a chance in the game. One other thing to point out, it's been mentioned on the show already this morning, Maurice Deegan.
The poor man.
I mean, it's worth watching because simply because of how he handled it, I think. He was absolutely flattened. He got into a Downs Crokes sandwich and he was prone, stricken for about 10 seconds. The game was continuing because there was no one to blow it up, as it were. And he just got on with it, and when the play naturally stopped, he then took a breather, understandably. So that was a moment of levity in what was a very difficult watch and listen for Downs fans, Westmeath GA fans. And after the game, speaking to Aisling O'Rourke, Larwall, he cut an understandably dejected figure. Here we're going to hear him reflecting on what was a better second half performance in what has been a successful season for the club.
We weren't in a great place at half time, but listen, we battled well in the second half, and we brought back the scoreboard a little bit anyway, and possibly could have done a bit more as well, you know. But listen, that's the nature of it, you know.
Well, I'm sure it's tough at the minute, but it's been some journey for the Downs, you know, to be here in a Leinster final, 50 years since the last one, I think 17 years since you won the Westmeath Championship. So, yeah. You know, it's an incredible journey, and you've been there to lead them, Lair.
Yeah, well, listen, as I said to the lads in there, you know, we're devastated tonight. I mean, you know, a lot of people were saying we're in bonus territory, and we don't buy that. Like, it's you know, when you arrive, you want to win, and you're very disappointed if you lose, and it has to be like that. But I suppose when we reflect back, it has been a really positive year, and please God, we'll take some learnings from today, you know, a harsh lesson, yeah.
You've been involved with quite a few teams. This has been hugely successful. You've had success before. Where would you rate this, I suppose, in terms of the team and the journey you've been on?
Yeah, it was for me personally, it's, you know, it was a fantastic year. Coming in, I had no real, you know, you just try and, you know, bring on players as best you can. And I think we clicked. I think, you know, they're a young group. They were very enthusiastic and had a great appetite for learning and I suppose it just worked, and we got a bit of momentum, and that can happen, you know. So listen, it was a fantastic year for me, you know.
Aisling O'Rourke might be a little bit confused, either sitting at home or in her car listening to this, wondering how she was in Croke Park yesterday evening when that indeed, of course, was Aisling O'Reilly.
Right.
My sincere apologies to both of them. Luke Loughlin battled manfully throughout the game, joint captain. By the time the Downs started scoring, however, the game was dead as a contest, as we already discussed, Will. He's been one of the stars generally for GAA in 2022. Tarleton Cup winner with Westmeath, league champions, county champions and provincial finalists with the Downs. However, at Croke Park last night, speaking to, again, Aisling O'Reilly, he was pretty dejected.
Obviously, raging is the only word. Bad start killed us, you know. Personally then as well, for myself, kicking a few eyes, and supposedly as captain you want to do your best, and when you don't perform it's not nice, but look, kept going and never give up, I suppose. You can kind of be proud of that, but maybe our journey in Leinster could be like our trying to win a championship in Westmeath. Took a few attempts you know, so maybe we can use this experience and push on in the next few years, you know, like, this isn't, none of this is granted, like, you know, so it is hard work, and, like, getting out of Westmead again is going to be tough, but if we can, maybe we can use it as a fuel or experience, or, you know, we'll be a year older, a year wiser again, so that's all you can do.
Yeah, because as you said, it was, I think, 16 years, 17 years since you won that championship in Westmead, so amazing to be here in a Leinster final. You know, that stuff of dreams for clubs, and you were able to do it, you know, this small enough club in Westmead. You know, it's incredible to be able to say that.
Yeah, like, it is, but when you're here, you want to win, and, like, the way we started, you don't think that that's going to happen. You never think that's going to happen, but obviously it does happen, and it happens a lot, but you can just, all you can do is keep going, and look, this was all a bonus for us after we won the county title of Westmead, and we just took it in our stride, you know, like, leaving the Downs today, I think there were 6 or 7 buses, you know, when we were leaving, like, that's class to see, and we can just try and learn from them maybe a small bit. Enjoy tonight, and we'll come back again in the new year, hopefully, and with a new plan, and go again.
Now, one other game, also involving Kilmacud, the Leinster Senior Hurling Club final, and they actually had a stunning comeback. It wasn't enough to defeat Ballyhale of Kilkenny, but they were close.
They were close. It's really interesting, actually, because you've got the club represented twice on the same day. You've got all the footballers watching the hurlers, and they would have been so dejected had the game finished with like 13, 14, 15 points between the two sides in that instance. I mentioned Shane Walsh, who, of course, recently joined Kilmacud Crokes, the footballers. He was saying after the game that having watched the comeback of their side against Ballyhale Shamrocks, it actually helped fasten their mentality to deny the Downs comeback in the second half in the subsequent game. So that was an interesting kind of unique dynamic based on the fact that Crokes had two sets of representatives in the hurling and in the football. They got close to making it a remarkable provincial double in the sense that they had a 14-point gap to close with 25 minutes to go, and it finished 2-22 to 2-19. Ultimately, though, it was Ballyhale Shamrocks, the best side in the province, and they have been for a number of years. They are remarkable. TJ Reid, I read some comments from him afterwards, like, he was furious. He was really, really annoyed that his side had allowed a game that was by far so in control from their perspective that they thought they couldn't and shouldn't allow Crokes to get the foothold that they did in that game. But for the neutral, anyone watching on yesterday or listening to Joe Troy on Midlands 103, it certainly served as a great build-up to what we were hoping would be a great football final. As things transpired, Crokes got 1 out of 2. The Downs are 0 for 2 in provincial finals, just like in 1970. They struggled to win on the provincial final stage. It really has been a really quality season, and I'd focus in on Luke Lachlan's final words there of his audio. You know, he saw 6-7 coaches all bussing it down to Dublin for a great day out, and ultimately those are the moments that inspire the cultures in society that can lead to greater sporting engagement. So you hope and expect that the Downs and Westmead GAA have plenty more good days ahead.
Hear, hear. Now, still to discuss, Shane Lowry closing out the year with a tricky time in the Bahamas, and the World Cup continuing to throw up plenty of surprises. More details after these.
The Monday Sports Review, brought to you by Slater Kia. Introducing the new EV6 fully electric SUV with a range of over 500 kilometres. Find out more at Slater Kia Mullingar.
Just pick out this one comment on the Downs complimenting the guys on a great job to get as far as they did. Kilmacud Crokes have a huge area to pick players from, terrific resources at their disposal, and Shane Walsh carried them through much of the game, says this message. Now, moving on to the World Cup, and in the round of 16, Japan take on Croatia today as Brazil go up against South Korea. The last 16 includes as well England, France, Argentina and the Netherlands, who all impressed on their way to the quarterfinals. England scoring 3 goals to no reply against Senegal. France getting 3 and really a last-minute goal from Robert Lewandowski, but Poland on the score sheet, just 3-1. Argentina 2, Australia 1, and the Netherlands 3, USA 1.
Yeah, the big boys have started to kind of stretch their legs in this tournament, and the group stages threw up a very kind of proportional and even last 16, in the sense that I think at my count you had 9-7 in terms of the ratio of big teams and maybe smaller teams, in quote unquote. So most groups played out as you'd expect, and then two groups that didn't, funny enough, still produced. We've got Morocco topping their group. However, Spain surprisingly didn't top their group. So Morocco v Spain, and Japan topping their group was a surprise. But the way it's worked out is ultimately that the quarterfinals are likely to be all big teams, if you want to, again, give me the quote unquotes there. Forgive me for that. Let's look at what happened last night. England, they were really, really bad for about 37 minutes. They could not get any sense of momentum against a Senegal side that looked organised, determined and really fired up. There's a decent amount of Senegalese players who would have had experience playing in the Championship and the Premier League historically and presently, and England really suffered against them for a while. It wasn't dissimilar to their struggles against the United States, who might have employed a similar shape in terms of tactics. They started to move Senegal around, finally finding space. They were closer to being the sum of their parts. It definitely wasn't a part of the plan, I would say, to be that stingy for the first half an hour or so, but it's clear that if they get close to their best, they're close to being one of the best sides in the tournament. Their quarterfinal coming up against France will be a really fascinating contest. Just to look at some of the performers for England, those that stood out, Bukayo Saka came back into the squad after being rested or dropped, whatever way you want to look at it, for the Wales game. He had one sloppy moment which produced a good chance for Senegal, but he scored a great finish and he was full of trickery. Jude Bellingham, I think if while the World Cup is on and we're talking about it, I will always have to mention him. He is an unbelievable 19-year-old footballer. So mature. The way he goes around the pitch, cajoling his experienced international teammates, players who have an absolute armful of medals and trophies, and he berates them if they've made a mistake, because he just knows what the game is about. And in every microcosmic moment where he's fighting over inches on the pitch or he's galloping down the pitch to set up a goal, he just seems to be 9 out of 10 every game I've ever seen him. So Jude Bellingham, I think, is in the running to be named as one of the players of the tournament, or the player of the tournament. I'd be shocked if he's not in the team of the tournament, as it were. Harry Kane is worth a mention on the basis that he's finally hit the back of the net at this World Cup, and it wouldn't be a surprise to see him do a few more times that over the course of the knockout rounds. That being said, they're going to have to deal with France, as I said, Will. They're similar to England in the sense that they've got the players. They should be blowing away the likes of Poland, but for much of the first half against Poland, they really huffed and they puffed, and they didn't get too far in terms of threatening chances or anything along those lines. And it took Olivier Giroud just on the cusp of half time. I mean, what would have happened to this game had Poland got in at the game being scoreless at half time? We don't know. Giroud's an interesting player in the sense that those who watch the Premier League will know his days of Arsenal and Chelsea, and he splits opinion for being practical, effective, a good goal scorer, but lacks pace, isn't as exciting as some of the other luminaries in the league or international. Nationally, he's the record goal scorer in the history of France football, which is nothing to be sniffed at. He got the record goal yesterday evening. That's his yesterday afternoon, I should say. It's his 52nd international goal. France at that point relaxed, and Kylian Mbappe basically took over. I saw a quote, Matty Cash. He plays for Aston Villa, Will. He's got a Polish mother and he's declared for Poland. It's great to see him. He's there. He knows the national anthem word for word, belting it out. He's fully bought in, and it, apparently he gets on great with the squad there, except he was playing right back to Mbappe's left wing. He said after the game that his legs started burning like he'd never experienced trying to keep up with the French winger, which is some endorsement, I think. And Mbappe scored a double, two very Mbappe-like finishes. He's got 5 goals for the competition. He's leading the Golden Boot rankings, and he was quick afterwards to insist that he doesn't care about it. It's about France winning the World Cup. Kyle Walker, who was a bit shaky for England against Poland at right back, he's going to have to assume the Matty Cash role. And that, I think, would worry England. I think Gareth Southgate might even bring in Kieran Trippier, who is a very accomplished fullback in his own right. They might go five at the back with Walker and Trippier double teaming Mbappe. And even still, you'd think that Mbappe is going to give them a real headache. Elsewhere, Argentina were 2-1 winners the night previous against Australia. Lionel Messi scored the crucial opening goal in that one. Netherlands 3, USA 1. They're very quietly and efficiently moving their way through the tournament like they tend to. So it's Netherlands against Argentina on Friday. That looks like a real 50-50 quarterfinal. Like I said, the organisation teamwork of the Netherlands against Messi and everyone around him trying to get Messi to a World Cup final, including all the neutrals, I'd say. And Will, you mentioned the other two last 16 days, I should say, today and tomorrow, to produce the last two quarterfinals. Japan take on Croatia at 3. It's Brazil against Korea Republic or South Korea this evening. And then Morocco take on Spain tomorrow. And it's Portugal v Switzerland, which would be the last of the last 16 games. And then we're into the final 8. And for those who don't like the World Cup, Will, there will be a couple of days break after tomorrow. So some people can get a breather from it.
All right. Can we get up to date on Pelé? I've heard different things over the weekend. What's the state of his health, do we know?
We don't know, frankly. We can't get up to date on it in the sense that there were reports that he was going into palliative care at one stage, that his cancer treatment, he had not been stopped responding to it. He then came out and released a statement saying that he was having his monthly interaction with the health service and that he was fine and everything's A-OK. His family now say that he's not been moved to palliative care. Reports indicated that he was in that situation, as I said. But his daughter has now come out and said likewise. It was also interesting to see the tributes coming out. You know, Pelé didn't play today, yesterday or the week before, Will. And you've got the likes of Harry Kane and Kylian Mbappe speaking so glowingly and specifically about him. Pray for the king is what Mbappe said on Twitter. And Harry Kane, captain of England, called him an inspiration among everyone in the game, incredible footballer, incredible person. And it goes to show just how much he transcended the game when it comes to his name and his exploits. His family say they're confident he's going to be returning home from hospital when his condition improves. He's got colon cancer, so it's complicated at his age as well. And we can just touch wood and hope that he will be fine. Certainly it just, the weekend gave you a hint and a sensation for just how much of an impact that man has had on the world, let alone the world of football.
Before we move on to golf and Shane Lowry's difficult time in the Bahamas, a milestone in racing. Honeysuckle has finally been beaten.
Yeah. And, you know, those connected with racing who follow it day in, day out will tell you that it's beyond inevitable. Like horses, they have a racing shelf life, as it were, that's relatively contracted over. The best Grade 1 winners tend to compete at the highest level for a couple of years, and the very, very, very best can do it for maybe 3 or 4 years. And she's just been the mare of a lifetime for racing fans, let alone the owner, Kenny Alexander, Henry de Bromhead, the trainer, and of course, Rachel Blackmore, the jockey. She had such a wonderful relationship with that horse, and Rachel Blackmore brought the sport of racing to the floating fan or viewer in a way that no other jockey has done, and in large part that was in partnership with Honeysuckle, who won 16 consecutive races unbeaten in race rules up until the weekend just gone, where she finished third in the Hatton's Grace Hurdle, a race that she won 3 times prior to that. Tiapu and Classical Dream were the two that got in ahead of her, Gordon Elliott's Tiapu and Willie Mullins' Classical Dream, in that order. They're both graded race winners in their own right and deserving of having finished ahead of her on this occasion. And she can have no excuses on the basis that approaching the last, she was in position, let's say, and usually Rachel will say go and Honeysuckle will burn them off. And we had a hope that the champion hurdle might be played out between Constitution Hill, a Nicky Henderson trained horse in England, who was odds on to win that race despite Honeysuckle's record. And then imagine an undefeated but underdog Honeysuckle coming over for Ireland, let's say, quote unquote. It would have been a great contest. She's been beaten now. Can she bounce back? That remains to be seen. You would think we might have seen the best of her, but in fairness, the best of her was really incredible.
And finally then, Shane Lowry closing out the year with a tricky time in the Bahamas. Tiger Woods continuing to battle against his own body.
Yeah, let's talk about Tiger Woods in a moment. As ever, a fascinating character. But Shane needs to be looked at just in terms of how difficult and inconsistent his golf was this weekend, which was really standing in stark contrast to how consistent and of a high quality his golf was throughout the year. But you sense that it's a really good time. It's just a good time for him to stop playing. He said as much, actually. Our reporter, Oisin Coyne, caught him in Tullamore when he was opening up the old warehouse in the town. And he was saying how he really dislikes playing at this time of year. Like, he never finds a way of getting good form, whether it's psychological, physical, or a combination of the two. He's a man who needs a break around this time. And that played out. He shot a 75 on the first round, which is tricky enough. But he then went 6 over for 6 holes on his second round, which meant that his last two rounds of 71-71, picking up a couple of shots on average across the two rounds, were like a positive silver lining on what ultimately is and was a negative weekend for Shane. But I think we all know he's got the game to compete for the big trophies and occasions. And when he comes back fresh in the new year, we can look forward to him mounting significant challenges for the best tournaments in the game of golf. Tiger Woods, can he do that? I don't know. He still talks in terms of winning in the future. He had this shocking car crash almost 2 years ago. His foot was nearly amputated. Rory McIlroy shortly afterwards said, "Stop trying to make him out to be some sort of superhero. He's in a bad way, and he may never come back." Remarkably, he's playing golf again. He made the cut at the Masters last year, which is just bananas. But at the moment, he's got plantar fasciitis, which is a symptom of not being able to walk enough, so that when he walks around a golf course, the soles of his feet react and give out great pain. It's something that happens in martial arts, funny enough, plantar fasciitis. But Tiger Woods suffering from that at the moment. And it seems to be just a knock-on effect after knock-on effect. Whether or not he can get on top of those for the four majors of the year and maybe one or two prep tournaments, we'll have to wait and see. But as ever, he's compelling to listen to and to watch. And hopefully in the new year, he's someone that we can watch as well.
David, as always, thank you very much. Lots of lovely pictures of the moon on Saturday, and many people wondering what caused this ring to appear in the cold night air. Well, Shawnee Morris is here from the Midlands Astronomy Club. What's it called?
It's called a moon halo or a lunar halo. In some regards, you can actually see it with the sun in cold weather as well. So it's not necessarily a unique or a rare phenomenon. We just don't pay attention to it. But
well, I could imagine the sun, because it emits heat, meeting against the cold air. The moon, however, just reflects light.
That's true. But the phenomenon itself, it can be easy to explain but lengthy, but I'll try and give you the abridged version here. Okay. So if you can imagine, as you look at the moon when it's gone past first quarter or before third quarter, so half to full back to half, okay? And as you look up at the moon, imagine in the coldness of the night, you are looking up towards a tunnel of light. So the moon halo, which is exactly 22.5 degrees in diameter, is the light being reflected by usually hexagonally shaped ice crystals high up in Earth's atmosphere. So they're bouncing around and they're coming down towards the observer on the ground. You do have to have cold weather. It can be seen on a cold summer's night too, so it's not restricted to just the winter months, but we see it a lot more because it's naturally colder. So as this cold front is moving in over the next couple of days, and if we have some clear nights and it does get dark, the moon is visible at the moment, do take time to have a look up as it's there. It could offer a nice photographic opportunity for people who like their photography, especially nighttime photography, because the moon halo juxtaposed against bare trees or houses and foreground objects like that, it adds a sense of mystery or ambience to it. It's something that's been used an awful lot in October weather because of coming up to Halloween. It was often thought to have supernatural or superstitious properties to it, but it's a completely natural phenomenon.
Yeah. Actually, you can get apps on your phone now which allow you to take those more professional photographs, leaving the exposure open for longer.
Yes, that's right. That's what you need. Whereas you can play around with those settings so as not to have the moon completely saturate the image, but enough that you do get the halo around the moon. By the way, when you do see it with regards to a sun, you might only see it as part of a halo to the left or to the right. And then when you see that, it looks like a little bit of an arc of a rainbow. It's called a sundog.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. Shawnee, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Midlands Astronomy Club, look them up online. Now, back to our earlier debate about the dole and whether you should have a higher rate for people who lose their job on higher incomes. Now, one person points out they're currently on sick leave and they receive illness benefit. They were 18 years in their job and they are fixed on €208 per week. No fuel allowance, no bonus, no help at Christmas. How fair is that, they ask. I should have signed up for the dole. So it's not just about the unemployment benefit. You have to look at all of the reasons somebody may lose their job. Thank you to Chloe Farrell and to Sinead Hubble for putting the programme together. We're back on your radio tomorrow morning from 9, hopefully sounding a little healthier. Carol James is coming next with the afternoon show. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Bye-bye.